Welcome to High Noon, where we talk about controversial subjects with interesting people. I have a long-term friend of mine on the pod, John Daniel Davidson. I've been following his work for a very long time, years and years at this point, back when the Federalist listserv was popping. John is an editor with the Federalist, but what we're here to talk about today is this book. If you're on YouTube, you can see this, Pagan America, The Decline of Christianity and the Dark Age to Come. So welcome, John, to High Noon.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you, Inez.
It's great to see you. So let's start with the basics, which is the definition of paganism, because your thesis in this book is that we are entering a post-Christian age and returning to a kind of earlier pagan ethos. So what do you think characterizes that ethos, and why are you sort of comparing two ends of things that on the surface might not seem immediately similar, right? We don't have temples to Apollo, and, you know, still like yet. Things like witchcraft are very fringe. So what about our current moment would you define as pagan?
Yeah. So I mean pagan and paganism in a broad sense. Paganism wasn't just a set of religious rituals or cosmological beliefs about the natural world and how society should be organized. It was also an ethos and a way of understanding, you know, how society should be organized and what is right behavior, what is wrong behavior. I mean paganism in a very broad sense. And I say in the book that the paganism that we're seeing emerge now is unlike and is going to be very unlike the paganism that existed in the time before Christianity. So we're not going, as you say, to see temples to Zeus and Apollo popping up in Times Square, although we are seeing a resurgence of popularity in what I call sort of moral therapeutic witchcraft or moral therapeutic pagan practices, which is sort of combined with feminism and some other things. But we're going to see the pagan ethos emerge more and more as we enter this post-Christian era. And the pagan ethos is two things primarily. One is a kind of radical moral relativism, right? That says might makes right. There are no transcendent, overarching universal truths about human nature or about the world, or about our behavior. And so this tyranny of moral relativism on the one hand, and on the other hand, the form that eventually takes, because relativism doesn't just stay relative, right? It devolves into power dynamics. And so the form that will take, I argue, is a kind of tyranny or, pagan slavery or pagan empire, which is the form pagan societies always took in the past. And I'm arguing that we're starting to see that emerge now in the post-Christian era, that what the future holds for America isn't this sort of secular liberal utopia, right, of neutral public spaces and kind of a live and let live ethos. That's not what the end of Christianity in America is going to bring. It's going to bring a new kind of tyranny and what is fundamentally a pagan kind of tyranny.
I think we've seen a lot of evidence of this with the recent implosion, completely after a long decline in terms of public influence, I would say, of the new atheism movement.
Yeah.
Where you have Ion Hersiali converting to Christianity in, let's say, what is a somewhat heterodox explanation that relies less on belief in Jesus Christ and more on the kind of arguments that you're actually making in your book, right? Which are ultimately, making arguments about what kind of society Christianity builds. And then having Richard Dawkins sort of condescendingly respond to that. And this is after a long decline where a lot of these spaces of kind of rationalist movement or new atheist movement, I mean, really after the death of Christopher Hitchens, who was, of course, the finest of them, it seems like they have almost nothing to say to modern, to like the modern moment in a way, because It seems like, even on a vibe level, it seems really clear that they essentially have missed all the most important intellectual movements. And even within their followers themselves, most of them are now, as you say, devolving from a kind of materialistic relativism into very, very strong normative claims that are just not Christian or not religious, right?
Post-Christian, right? So there does seem to be
some impulse there that devolves into, we can call it truth claims, right? Just asserting some kind of truth claims that are not, go beyond what can be materially proved with the scientific method.
That's right. Yeah. The idea that the only thing that's true are the things that we can measure with our scientific instruments is a very mid-20th century claim. And these atheists, and I talk about this in the book, these kind of new atheists that everybody, you know, was buzzing about a couple decades ago, they look very antique now in 2024. And they, as you said, they really have nothing to say about our moment, and the moment that we're in is really the emergence of the post-Christian era and the broad contours of which we can begin to see. And more what we're seeing are normative truth claims that aren't based on scientific rationalism or, you know, cold, hard materialism. They're based on like metaphysical, normative, spiritual claims about what is true or what could be true. those kinds of claims, when they're not rooted in you know, the Christian tradition, right? The tradition of natural law, of universal moral, universal morality, they devolve into power dynamics very quickly. And in the pagan world, they always did, which is why pagan societies always eventually, once they got advanced enough, took the form of slave empires. Like across vast expanses of time and geography and cultures, it was the same thing over and over again. The names of the gods changed, but the form of society was strikingly similar. What I'm saying in the book, part of what I'm saying is that the materialism and the sort of secularism of the that we've seen over the past century or so was in some way sort of a brief interlude between Christendom and post-Christendom. And it's starting to break down now. And you know, the claims that of science, or, you know, we follow the science, you start to see these absurd situations. And we've all seen them over the past few years, especially with COVID and with in our politics. These claims of being like, we follow the science, you know, we're all about the science. And then what people do, and even what our governments have done, is advanced policies that are totally divorced from the science, that have nothing to do with science or even, like, you know, the data that's out there, right? If you game that out and you extrapolate, like, well, why is this happening and where is it leading? It's leading toward what I call a pagan state, which is really sort of the modern post-Christian version of a pagan empire, where force is what determines, you know, government and policy, not principle, and certainly not anything like the basis of our Constitution, freedom of speech, the inherent human rights and dignity of each person, government by consent. All of those things go away once you reject the Christian foundation that they come from. They can't be sustained on their own, right? Because there's no basis for them anymore. So what is the basis of public life going to be? It's going to be force and coercion.
So here we've reached, I think, my first perhaps deviation or quibble with the definitions involved, because sure. The part of your book and your thesis that I agree with very much is the part you just articulated about, I would call it kind of the cut flower thesis, right? That Western civilization, absent the underlying, the underlying bedrock of Christianity, is not able to sustain human rights, natural right theory, is not able to sustain self-government, et cetera, et cetera. That part I find very convincing. But the definitions involved in what is pagan and what is not, I think my biggest objection in these definitions is that, as you just pointed out in your slave empire point about pagan empires, there is like a deep vein of natural inequality that is involved in impressing the will, right? Even if we talk about it in later terms, in Nietzschean terms, right? In impressing the will of a person on another. And there is just like a complete blanket acceptance of natural hierarchy and inequality. I mean, if you go back to the ancient world, right? Even what we think of as something like childhood, like the period of childhood, that idea really doesn't come around until much later and in relation to Christianity, because before there's just the stronger and the weaker, and children are, of course, the weaker. And so there's no concept of childhood innocence, for example. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that there actually is a quite important spark of sort of a bastardized Christianity in today's leftist, woke, whatever you want to call it, ethos, which is it has this very strong egalitarian goals. And it seems like it's taking, yes, I agree with you that it's a lot about power dynamics, and ultimately you do like reassert this hierarchy. And what we're seeing is an inverted hierarchy, so to speak, emerging, where, you know, if you're the biggest victim, then you have the most power. But that kind of focus on the victim or the weak or bringing
the marginalized
up, the marginalized to me seems very connected. And you know, people have pointed out that wokeism often looks a little bit like Puritanism without God or without Christianity, right? So that element to me seems very different from the ancient world and very different from paganism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. And I think part of the difficulty is one of vocabulary and terminology. But I would argue as well that to the extent that we see this kind of rhetoric, like among the woke left, right, and this invocation of the marginalized and the oppressed, and the demonization of the oppressor, that is the last vestiges, right, of Christian civilization. And we're seeing it's sort of an instinctive reversion to these terms and these categories that the post-Christian, let's say the post-Christian left, for the purposes of this discussion, are using when they invoke the oppressed or the marginalized and assert their rights or their position over and against the powerful or the oppressor, right? And in some ways, the invocation itself is nonsense and is completely kind of an offense against reason and common sense of what we can see, right? The oppressors are not the ones who are claiming to be oppressed. They are the ones who have power. And they are invoking victim status as an expedient, I think, right now, and increasingly a cynical expedient, that because it's so obvious that those who are claiming to be victims are the ones who wield all the power. I think that is a, like I said, the last vestiges of the sort of Christian cosmology that are left over, that are in the process right now of being abandoned. And I think we're seeing more and more that they will be abandoned entirely in favor of pure kind of explicit arguments based on power alone, and those with power, you know, wielding it for what they say is the good, but not pretending to be victims. I think we're going to come to the end very quickly of this notion that victims have no power, and that this, as I say, this sort of a terminology problem or disconnect is going to be resolved, and the truth of the matter, which we already know, is going to be made more explicit in the terms in which we have these debates in public.
I think there's something deeper there, because I take what you're saying about the terms, and I do think the left is going to exercise more naked power and more naked appeals to power. But there is that essence of revolt against nature, mm-hmm. right? And we see that in the egalitarian claims about men and women, among other things, right? There is this idea at the heart of the current leftism to me, which is that the sort of the strictures of nature are oppressive. Whereas paganism, yeah, I see very much as the opposite of the kind of embrace of nature and nature being red in tooth and claw, and therefore circumventing or laying aside objective morality in that sense. And there is no acceptance of nature being red in tooth and claw in leftism, right? Like, there's no acceptance that some people are beautiful and others ugly, or that some people are prosperous and smart and others are dumb and lazy, right? There's no acceptance of those kinds of unpleasant natural truths. Whereas I see the Christian ethos, you know, not from the theological perspective, but from this kind of societal perspective that we're talking about, and indeed the Jewish ethos as well, and even Muslims, I think monotheistic religions of the West, as opposed to pagan ethos, was very much about recognizing and acknowledging sort of the depravity of nature, but then trying to build something better, more virtuous than that. Right. And I don't see that at all. Like with today's leftism, it's just is very, everything is socially constructed, mm-hmm, right? Whereas the pagans did not believe that everything was socially constructed. They believed in the power of the powerful over the weak, because that's what nature or hierarchy or the world, yeah, had produced among human beings.
Right. I think the new pagans also believe of the rule of the powerful over the weak. They're not quite ready to say it, but I think that's clearly their program. It's clearly the world that they want to bring into being, is a world where the powerful do as they want to do, and a class, a kind of new clerisy, rules over an underclass that will be designated by the rulers, and that power itself will be exercised by the powerful on their behalf. And that is maybe the most striking element of the pagan past that Christianity overthrew, and that the new pagans are kind of inverting now, and are reverting to that power dynamic where power is exercised by the powerful on their own behalf, not on behalf of the powerless or the masses. Your point about rejecting nature is an important one, and it gets to something I discuss in the book, which is that the new paganism has new gods and new kind of manifestations of the pagan ethos. And toward the end of the book, I begin to discuss some of those, but it does stem from kind of this, transhumanism. The transhumanist movement and the transgender movement are really great kind of arresting examples of this rebellion against nature that you talk about, that the idea that we can overcome nature and create ourselves in a way and become our own gods, right? Which is really at the heart of a lot of the transhumanist and transgender kind of ideology. But I think that too is a way station en route to somewhere else. One of those places that it's on the way to is seeing technology as a kind of god, and indeed treating it as if it were a god, a being itself that should and maybe must be obeyed for all of our own goods. And we see this especially in the debate over artificial intelligence, and the people who are creating artificial intelligence right now talk about it in those terms, as though they are creating new gods. The implication being that these are gods that we're going to need to listen to, and maybe that governments are going to have to mandate things based upon what these algorithms, these entities are telling us to do. But I do think that the revolt against nature is part of a the difference, you know, the differences between ancient paganism, pre-Christian paganism, and modern or neo-paganism is that there's an attempt here to overcome nature, but there's still going to be, it's not, the end point for us is not, just like with the secularists and the rationalists of the last century, the end point isn't like, okay, we're our own gods now, and then that's the stopping point. We're going to go past that, and we're already seeing how we're going to go past that. There's going to be other things that we hold up as gods, right? I quote the writer Paul Kingsnorth, who's a great, he's great on this stuff. He says that there's a throne at the center of the culture, and something's going to sit on it. It's not going to be us. It's not going to be the individual. I don't think human beings are wired that way. And so the new gods will be called something different than the old gods, and they will be served and worshiped by a post-Christian society in a different way than the pagans in the pre-Christian era served and worshiped their gods. But I think that we're going to see some gods being elevated, and not centuries from now. I think in our lifetimes, we're going to begin to see it more and more clearly.
Yeah, I mean, it's even possible that there will end up being two flanks of this, right? Because I could see a kind of right-wing Nietzschean embrace of hierarchical nature.
Yeah.
And also a more egalitarian form that you're talking about. I still think egalitarianism is like, you can have a sort of explicit will to power within egalitarianism, and it's the Harrison Burgeon, you know, will to power, right? It's the power to chop the tall off at the knees. But in
right, but then what? But then what happens, right? Once they've chopped the powerful off at the knees, I think that at that point you just have pure power dynamics. I mean, they have chopped the powerful off at the knees.
No. So I think the difference is, so it's who's in power, right? Like you could imagine a sort of right wing, let's say pagan ethos that whoever's in power is determined by sort of natural distribution of gifts. Mm-hmm. Whoever is smarter, stronger, you know, the better fighter can impose his will on the weaker. But you can also imagine a kind of like a collective use of power that hobbles the weak. And I feel like that is more, I'm sorry, hobbles the strong. And I do feel like that's more the essence of the left now. But let's talk about the public square a little bit, because you're talking about AI. And your discussion of AI here is really interesting, as well as, so like we have lost the ability to talk about any issue, including AI. But another example that comes to mind is the recent debate over IVF. And when I compare that to the debate even in the early 2000s over stem cell research, right? We have lost the language of talking about any substantive, whether it's technological issue or any kind of issue of governance, in moral terms in the public square. And you talk a lot about neutrality in this book and the facade of neutrality that is not able to be maintained. So first, can you lay out what you think the original vision of the American public square is, and then what is wrong with our current conception, and why we can't have or seem unable to have, and by we, I mean, at this case, the right is unable to have these kinds of normative discussions in the public square that actually assert some kind of vision of the good versus the left, which, as you do point out here, and we have been talking about for the last 25 minutes, right? The left at this point does assert a vision of the good.
Yeah.
It has very strong normative, despite all of the like language about materialism and you know, whatever it has a vision now. It has strong gods.
Yeah, and they've totally rejected the idea of a neutral public square or neutrality in national life and in public policy. I think that you know, in this sense, the left is right. that is to say, they're correct. I don't think that America was founded, or the American founders, and most Americans through most of our history, conceived of our public life being this sort of like neutral place where there are no normative claims, and that our national life would be kind of a blank slate where every voice was equal and every opinion, you know, was valid. I think, and I argue at the beginning of the book as part of the premise, that America specifically was founded as a Christian nation, right? Not to trigger accusations of Christian nationalism, but what I mean by that is that the kind of people that our founders had in mind who could maintain a republic of self-governing citizens, it had to be a predominantly Christian people. And by that, I think they weren't just thinking of like cultural Christians, like in the Richard Dawkins sense, the way Richard Dawkins thinks you can have the culture without the cult. I think they understood that the people themselves had to be moral and religious. They had to be they had to practice Christian virtues, and that only the kind of people that practiced Christian virtues were capable of self-government and the form of government, a Republican government they were setting up. And so you see right away, right from the beginning, from the founding generation on, provisions made to support religious and moral instruction and belief among the people. You see the first Congress appropriating public money for a chaplain for Congress, even before they ratified the First Amendment. So that tells you what they thought about whether or not they violated the Establishment Clause, right? You see appropriation of public funds and the writing into law in the Northwest Ordinance, provisions for churches in the new territories. You see massive support at the state and local level for Christian colleges and other sorts of explicitly religious institutions. I think the idea was that, you know, part of the federalism of the founding is that you had this overarching federal constitution or this federal framework that was going to be non-sectarian, but it was going to govern states and communities that were sectarian, that were denominational, that were confessional, right? Most, I don't know if most, but many of the original colonies at the time of the founding had religious establishments, and those were not like outlawed or banned by when the Constitution was ratified. Some of them kept those establishments well into the 19th century, and only over time and with you know, as part of a democratic process within those states were those establishments ended. But the founders themselves and the generations that immediately followed them didn't see those things as being in conflict. I think they imagined a Christian nation that was broadly non-sectarian, and that only that kind of a people were going to be able to maintain this thing that they had created. That's the argument I make in the book. I think the historical record supports that. And I give some, you know, examples of why, you know, of how we see that in the historical record. But yeah, the idea that we would have, you know, this wall of separation between church and state, I think has been badly misunderstood. And I think most Americans up until the middle of the last century, you know, understood that a wall of separation between church and state did not mean a radically secular and neutral public square. It meant that the churches, the faith communities, would be protected from the state, not that they would have no influence on public life.
So I really see three eras in American history of this, or with regard to this question of religion in the public square. So you have, and I think you rightly describe, the founding of America, which is a soft Protestant non-denominational establishment. It was a tolerant establishment. It made room in particular for Jews and actually for Muslims. But there was a very firm place, not only in the public square, but also in like public coffers, right, on the state level, for what was called non-denominational or non-sectarian. You've used the word sectarian, religious purpose, right? So you have towns, you know, paying out of the public purse to raise the church of the town. And when I think one of the clearest places you see this is in schools, right? Where you have a Bible reading in schools, there's kind of an agreement, and it's an agreement come to, not, you know, I know we think about it as a lofty top-down thing, and in some ways it is, you know, the statute of religious tolerance that Thomas Jefferson wrote, right? But there's also sort of this practical negotiation that happened in a lot of these towns, right? You have a divide between different denominations of Protestantism. You have Congregationalism, Unitarianism, which was much more serious in the founding as a religion. It wasn't just sort of what we think about today. Right. But you have like these actual fights about, okay, whose church are we going to raise, right? Whose preacher are we going to have on Sunday in the town square? And these are things that need to be negotiated. And the kind of detente that gets negotiated is actually very similar to what my husband, Jarrett, he went to a non-denominational Protestant school, right? And there's no particular, there's no Baptist theology versus right. Methodist theology, but there are certain principles, sola scriptura being one of them. So where I actually see this historically starting, this negotiation starting to break down, and you're not going to like it, John, is with mass Catholic immigration. If you look at the schools, for example, the Cincinnati Bible Wars in the mid 1800s, what ends up happening is that soft denominational non-denominational kind of detente between overwhelmingly what was sort of a Protestant public square with tolerated but completely excluded from the public square minorities, which is, you know, actually a situation that was very, very, worked very well for Jews, for example, right? But once you have mass Catholic immigration, then things like you start seeing fights over Bible reading in schools, right? Because this is pre-Vatican II, and the Catholic Church doesn't permit lay people to read the Bible at that point. So you have Catholic families objecting to the Bible reading in school, and that's when we start to see these fights about where money is going, and you see
amendments
proliferate in part to try to prevent that exact establishment mechanisms, those soft mechanisms that did fund religion in the public square, for when, you know, the town tipped to 55% Catholic families, to prevent those monies then from going to the Catholic Church. So I see that middle period before the 1960s as the final sort of nail in the coffin of American soft establishment. And I think there also, on a pragmatic level, the 1960s is when we moved from, you know, we had this fight between Protestants and Catholics in the public square. We kind of came to a detente on that fight, partially because of Vatican II, and partly because I think the great sort of, what do you call it, like a mercantile attitude of Americans very much blunted the edges in some ways of religious conflict. But then you come, you know, to modern America, post-World War II America, and now you're not just talking about primarily Protestants and Catholics and then a smattering of other people. You're talking about, you know, now you have objections if you mention Jesus, right? Because you have a large population of people who are either, you know, Jewish, Muslim, atheist, you know, any number of things, pagan. and you start having those demands. And the fact is, we really haven't legally resolved those questions. We kind of, if you look at those early Supreme Court cases, a lot of times what they're relying on is this notion of non-sectarianism that could not be sustained in a more diverse country, even when that diversity was the addition of a mass number of Catholics.
Well, I think I would disagree with your characterization that the mass immigration of Catholics is what was the sort of triggering incident that caused the system to break down. Because of course Catholics were record from the beginning. Catholic signed the Declaration of Independence. There were Catholic schools and institutions from the outset in America. There were provisions, you know, I can't remember which state, maybe New Jersey, kept their anti-Catholic laws on the books, your prohibition against Catholics serving in the state legislature until, like, you know, after the Civil War, something like that. It's an incredibly long time. But there was diversity between the states, and there was different kinds of laws in different places based on, you know, how many Catholics, you know, lived in different places. There we saw the, you know, the Blaine Amendments and sort of this anti-Catholic legislation come up in the 19th century, concurrent with mass Catholic immigration. But I would argue that the broad outlines of religious tolerance and the Christian character, small o Orthodox Christian character of America, remained intact despite mass Catholic immigration, and because obviously those Catholics themselves accepted the claims of the American Republic which were Christian, broadly construed, about the human person, about human rights and dignity. Those ideas themselves were Catholic long before they were Protestant. And I discuss some of the roots of that, of those ideas in the book as well. I think where it broke down wasn't the 1960s. It was a couple decades before that, even before World War II. It wasn't the proliferation of, you know, diverse non-Christian religions in America. Like, you know, in the 1940s through the 50s and into the 60s, you know, there was still a very strong supermajority of Americans that identified themselves as Christians, and indeed church attendance was still very, and membership was still very, very high, even as we were going through kind of the cultural and sexual revolution of the 60s. It was the introduction of secular notions and a misreading, I think, of Thomas Jefferson's separation of church and state. And I talk in some depth about the 1940 Cantwell Supreme Court case that ruled that, you know, a local government or a state government was not competent even to say what was a religious cause and what wasn't, for the purposes of issuing a permit to solicit donations, right? That was what the case was about. And the Supreme Court in that decision made a radical departure from all on First Amendment, you know, religious liberty questions, and especially on the Establishment Clause. This wasn't a free exercise case. It was an establishment case. And they said, if the state is going to be cognizant of religion, and they're going to issue permits for the solicitation of funds for a religious cause, that's not allowed. That's in the establishment of a religion. And the majority opinion went on this long disquisition about how, that the U.S. government and state governments and local governments could not participate or be cognizant or recognize religion or religious teachings in any way, and that was how the country had always been. And it was a total departure from how the Supreme Court and how I would argue just the American people at large had understood the role of religion in public life, and how it interacted with government at every level. And after that, that was in 1940. And after that, we're kind of off to the races on this notion that the government has to be like strictly neutral and strictly non-cognizant of religion. And from there, you know, the dominoes fall, you know, during and after World War II. And then we get into the 1960s where these cases about Bible reading and prayer in public schools are decided on the same basis. I think that was a major rupture, and it was secular ideas, there wasn't a sudden influx of non-Christian religions from immigrants that triggered this. It was secular ideas and a break, I think, with how the founders understood religion and the American system, the constitutional system that the founders created.
I certainly think that by the time you get, and yes, it starts with a smattering of cases beginning in the 40s, but by the time you get to the 60s, you really have a wholly foreign, I might like in the classic sense, definition of what it is to establish a religion.
Yeah.
That tension remains like in a lot of our cases today, because we do have at the same time this very expansive free exercise clause. And actually, I think these two clauses of the First Amendment, right, of the religious piece of the First Amendment, really do sum up some of the things that we've been talking about the balance here between establishment and religious liberty, right? So like we had different balances throughout American history of where that line tips, but these things are intimately related. And one of the things that, to my mind, is very much something that conservatives have to set their minds to erasing, in the same way that there was a long, decades-long movement to overturn Roe v. Wade, is this notion that we can play a tilted game with regard to the definition of religion and how it's considered in the public square. Because what we have right now is nearly endless tolerance in terms of free exercise, where basically anything can be declared a religion. Right. We have cases from the 60s and from the 70s, Vietnam War, conscientious objectors. There are special rights still carved out in the American Constitution for the exercise, free exercise of religion. But all that you can be secular and declare yourself a religion under this is the root of, like, I guess a more modern example would be the recent Church of Satan statue, and then in Iowa public what was it, like the legislature, right? The state house. So like we have this very expansive definition of freedom of religion itself under freedom of exercise. We have a completely tighter definition of religion when it comes to establishment. And that is what allows, because you could argue that just like the Vietnam War objectors had a secular worldview that hangs together and therefore were granted certain rights on the basis of their quote unquote religion. On the other hand, you could argue that there is a very determined worldview that hangs together that, for example, is established in our nation's schools today. It's a secular left-wing worldview. But that is not challengeable under any kind of like establishment doctrine, right? So we have this lopsided game whereby religious people are in a kind of two-step, protected as an island but completely pushed out of the public square and their ability to like influence public policy.
Yeah, this notion that your religion and your religious practice is something that is entirely private. You can practice it inside the walls of your home and the walls of your church, but it is not allowed to come out into the street. It's not allowed to come out into the public square. That, as you say, is a wholly foreign idea to our constitutional order of recent vintage. The intellectual framework for that, I think, was laid in the 1940s and, you know, prior to World War II, but it just exploded in the 1960s and 70s with this flood of Supreme Court cases and other developments in American society, such that you're absolutely right. There's a kind of dimitude, right, to borrow a term from the Islamic world, for traditionally religious people, where they have this kind of like second class status, or they're sort of supposed to be contained. Whereas,
can I briefly interject? It's gone even beyond the law, which is an important piece I was pointing to. But in that debate between IVF and going back to the stem cell research, it's now considered somehow presumptively illegitimate as a reasoning for the public square, which is why you get, you know, Biden saying, no, like my religion is completely separate from how I govern the country.
You know, and the first version of that, the first big kind of a political manifestation of that, which I discuss in the book, was JFK's speech in Houston during the 1960 presidential campaign, where he was speaking to a bunch of Protestant ministers trying to reassure them that his Catholicism would not influence his administration in any way. And that, you know, very much the kind of thing that we just heard from Biden, and was, I think, a betrayal and a reversal of how American politicians had discussed their faith and allowed their faith to influence their public pronouncements and their policies that they advocated for. And it was kind of this like Faustian bargain for JFK. Like, he wanted to be president and he needed the support of Protestant leaders to do it, and so he disavowed his Catholic faith And you know, and it worked. But it marked this huge shift in American life. And I think, to your point that there's no basis now, there's no basis to even argue, from a religious standpoint or from a moral standpoint against, something like IVF, even people who, you know, even the one side of our political divide that maybe should be making those arguments, or that you would expect to be making those arguments, is unwilling to make them because the ground is gone, you know, to make kind of normative claims that are grounded in a religious worldview, that ground is gone. And the whole field has been ceded to the secular, like, left, which is every bit as religious. And that's sort of like, you know, going back to paganism, they are the new pagans, and they are very religious. Even if they hide behind the fig leaf of secularism, there's nothing really secular about them or about their claims and about their programs. As you rightly note, public schools today, are giving a religious education. It's just not a Christian religious education.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of most of our institutions, and I think you're very right to point out that our post-religious age is not actually post-religious; it's post-Christian. I guess I'm left with a couple questions in all of this. The first is the question of genuine tolerance, right? How much latitude can be given without seeing what we have, which, if you accept your thesis that a lot of the things that we love about the West and about America cannot be separated from their roots I think it is the right phrase, America being a Christian country. And I actually have always had a beef with people over the phrase Judeo-Christian. I don't think that America has Judeo-Christian roots. I think America is a Christian country that was tolerant of Jews, which, of course, I think is a good thing. But those are two very different things, and it gets to the heart of the question, right? So, like, what, in your view, is the ideal relationship between Christianity and the public square, and where in there is there tolerance for people of other faiths or people who are atheists? I mean, how do we balance between the Inquisition and where we are now, which is kind of a soft establishment of secularism?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what we were discussing at the beginning of this conversation. I think tolerance, religious tolerance and sort of, you know, tolerance generally, is like free speech, you know, freedom of conscience, human rights. These are luxury goods that only Christian societies can afford, right? The early American Republic was able to tolerate, in the strict sense, was able to tolerate Jewish Americans. And, you know, we have George Washington's famous letter to the Hebrew congregation. They're able to tolerate communities of religious oddballs, right? In various parts of the country. And as the country expanded west, the number of oddball religious groups grew.
John is coming to us today from Alaska, the furthest reaches of
I'm all the way at the end of at the end of America,
more than the sun.
But I think that kind of tolerance is something that you have to have a certain kind of people to maintain. And the ideal, you ask about what's the ideal relationship. The ideal relationship is a country that is predominantly majority Christian, and not just like cultural Christian, but practicing, believing Christians, because they will have the virtues necessary for tolerance. They will tolerate people who have other views than they do. Not only other Christians that have other views, Catholics or Baptists on the one hand, or Presbyterians or Lutherans or whatever, but they'll also tolerate or Jewish people or Muslim people or Buddhists, but you have to have a critical mass of people who practice Christianity and who accept, and not only that, but an even larger critical mass of people who accept the claims of Christianity in order to have that kind of a society. And the problem with America in 2024 is that we are not any longer that kind of a society. We don't have enough people that practice the Christian religion and that buy the claims of Christian civilization. And so part of what I'm saying with the book is that it's going away. We have to wrap our minds around the fact that it's going away. We don't have enough people to maintain it. And as it goes away, something else is going to take its place. And one attempt of the book is to describe what that thing is that's taking its place.
Yeah, this really struck me when Billy Graham died. And as somebody who's obviously not Christian, doesn't come from sort of the Christian traditions at all, but they played some of his, you know, they published some of his own old sermons. And this is a guy who was, you know, very popular in the 1960s. So, you know, he was a modern, in many ways, like a modern. And you see some of those like elements of sort of modernity or kind of non-traditional elements in the way he talks about Christianity. But something that really struck me is how obvious it is that he is talking to a Christian nation that he believes he needs to call home, right? Yeah. So, you know, he's talking to people who have a background of Christian faith and maybe they've fallen off going to church every week. And that's really where he's focused. These sermons of his are, so even if you, you know, maybe even the people in your family who fell off going to church every week, or even your parents or your grandparents, but there's still this ethos that he's relying on to call people home. And it struck me listening to those sermons on, even on back then on NPR, even, they played after his death, and like how little that actually connects with the American public today, to your point.
Yeah, there was
aren't those like strings to touch, and you're starting from scratch, or even from hostile waters, I guess would be the.
Absolutely. That common religious vocabulary, and even that the common like basis of knowledge, like even just like something as basic as like knowledge of Bible stories and being able to catch biblical references. You saw that too in, you know, the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr. You know, there were all, you know, sort of peppered with biblical and Christian imagery and language. And I think MLK and Billy Graham, you know, in the 60s, that was kind of like the last gasp of public Christianity. They were the end of the dominant Christian culture in America that had persisted from the founding up until then. And after them, we step out into the void, and that's where we are now. And that's why I say in the book that this isn't, you know, the book is not a counsel of despair, because as a Christian and indeed as a Catholic, I believe that it was the encounter with Christianity that broke pagan empires in the past. And it will be as we enter this sort of new religious age, this new pagan age, there'll be a new openness to religious claims, and it will be a smaller but more powerful and faithful Christian church that will speak to, and I think convert this new pagan civilization that's coming into being. But it's not like a short-term project. This isn't something that's going to be resolved in our lifetimes. Trump isn't going to save you. No political movement is going to save or reverse the course that we're on as a civilization. It took centuries for us to get here, and it will take generations and maybe centuries to get out of it. And so, you know, while it's not a council of despair, one of the purposes of the books is to get Christians and to get just Americans who maybe are not Christians themselves, but who are cultural Christians, to wrap their minds around this and to accept it, and to accept that this is happening. And if it is happening, then that should inform what we do about it. And one of the things we should not do is to think that this election cycle or this movement is going to like turn things around. Because as you say, there's the threads are not there to pull on. And Billy Graham and MLK, that were pulling on the last threads. And so we're talking about like a reconversion of a once Christian people. And that may take a very long time indeed.
Yeah. My final question is about your final chapter, which is let's call it a respectful rejoinder or tweaking of a book by Rod Dreher called The Benedict Option. And it speaks to what I want to ask you to wrap up, which is, you know, what does that look like? What does living in a post-Christian nation look like? I mean, obviously you lay out some dire things in this book, but as you say, part of the point is for people to switch their mentality and their expectations. So what does it look like to be John Davidson and his family of Catholics in post-Christian America?
Well, we're out here on our compound in Alaska. Just no, so to the point about Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option, came out in 2017. It's a great book, and I try to be very fair to Rod. It was a book that was widely read. It resonated with a lot of people. Like a lot of his work, it was very prescient. But I think things have moved fast since 2017, faster than he or any of us maybe expected them to. And I think it's not enough to just kind of move out to your compound and have your homeschool and your church community and hunker down in your ark and ride out the storm, right? I think that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. And one of the things I describe in the last chapter is a need to embrace a mentality that says we're going to preserve the flame in our families and in our churches and in our communities, and we're going to pass the faith on to our children, but we're also going to look for ways to bring our faith back out into the public square and proclaim it to a post-Christian culture and a post-Christian people, even if that means persecution, right? The persecution is nothing new to the Christian church, although it's been a long time since we've experienced it, at least in the West. I know that that the modern era has brought great persecution to Christians in the East, and we should look to them as an example of how to be and how to be bold. But a lot of it is finding and fighting on ground you can win. And I talk about some examples of that in the book about, you know, it may be that you have to make major changes to your life, that you may have to move to a new city or a new part of the country so that you can not only have that thick community that where the faith can be active, but where you can have other people and other families that will go out into the public square with you and fight with you, whether that is doing Catholic saints processions through the streets on feast days, or taking over your city council, taking over your school board, taking over your local library, and as far as you are able to, bringing Christian convictions and Christian morality back into public life and say, we're not going to have this pornographic material in our schools in this town. We're not going to have this stuff in our libraries. We are going to have a Christmas parade. We are going to have nativity scenes, you know, bringing back this older mode of being an American where the Christian religion was part of our public life together. It was part of our public pronouncements, our monuments, our festivals, and fighting for that and being willing to fight for that and being willing to pay a cost for that. And that's the last chapter of the book is entitled the Boniface Option, after Saint Boniface, who was the apostle to the Germans, who famously cut down the sacred oak tree in front of a crowd of outraged pagans and built a church to Saint Peter with the wood. He should be our example, knowing that he was also at the end of his life cut down by a pagan raiding party on the missionary grounds where he spent his whole life. So that's my counsel to the extent that I have any, but it's a counsel to sort of like prepare for war, because war is upon us. And the only question is what are we going to do about it?
Thank you so much for coming on High Noon, John Davidson. The book is Pagan America. It is an incredibly thought-provoking book. I really recommend reading it. I'm still sorting through my thoughts on various parts of it. Richard Dawkins needs to read this book. If he has the courage to face the fact that some of the things that he likes may be indistinguishable in the long term from the things that he hates, or inseparable would be a better word. But John, this was a fascinating read. I really highly recommend people read it. Where can they find this book, and where can they find the rest of your work?
As you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a senior editor at The Federalist, and so that's where I write most often. I'm on unbanned from Twitter now at John D. Davidson. And the book you can get at Amazon or Thrift Books or Barnes & Noble, I've been told, is carrying it. So wherever it is that you get your books, you can get it there. And it's also, there's an audio version available as well.
And thank you to our listeners. High Noon with Inez Stepman is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. As always, you can send comments and questions to inez.stepman@iwf.org. Please help us out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. Be brave, and we'll see you next time on High Noon.